For WAMC News, I'm Jim Lavoulis. The 2019 climbing season on Mount Everest was marred by deaths and incredible photos of people waiting in line on the summit ridge in their attempts to reach the world's highest peak. Nepal's government issued a record number of climbing permits for this spring season, roughly 400, a figure that does not include several hundred Sherpa guides and support crews. British adventurer and writer Adrian Hayes has summited Everest and K2. I spoke with him about why more people are making the risky attempt to reach the summit of Everest, 29,029 feet above sea level.
People climb big mountains and always have done for, you know, the freedom, but setting that challenge, nature, the teamwork, the beauty, getting to the top, all these things. The real thing that spiked it, and this is where Everest is just the tip of the iceberg, is what social media has done. And it's that striving for recognition, respect, and basically, you know, that look where I am, look what I've done, and look at me. And that's the sad reality of where we are now.
And what dangers are created or amplified by having so many people trying to summit Everest in one season or at one time?
Yeah, look, you know, this striving for recognition, and I will say it's an unconscious thing as much as conscious. Conscious in some people, unconscious in others. You know, in most walks of life, it's pretty harmless. In many walks, it's unintegral. In some walks, it's annoying. But of course, when it comes to a big mountain, it can be very dangerous. And look, you know, whenever there's a death on Everest, and there's basically about a 1% in 100 chance of you die. So every 100 people that summit Everest, be it 1 to 2 people will die each year. Now, the general public tend to think that that's, you know, that's crazy and this is outrageous to be stopped. What I would say to that is nobody forced these people to go up the mountain. It's there by free choice. But the queues, you know, it's a very short window on all these mountains. And when you've got so many hundreds of people going up there, you're going to get people succumbing to the effects of altitude, exposure, hypothermia, rockfall, avalanche, all these things. And, you know, it amplifies the dangers, and people are going to be dying more and more who, you know, shouldn't be. It's not their fault. And that's the real sort of crying shame of what's happening now.
One of the ideas to limit the number of climbers on Everest is some sort of experience requirement. So forcing people to show that they have similar mountain climbing experience. In your mind, will this just lead to more people flooding other mountains that might be less watched, have less oversight, in order to get a notch in their belt to hopefully climb Everest sometime in the future?
Yeah, look, we've already got an overflow of people on the so-called seven summits. This is the seven highest mountains in the world: Kilimanjaro, Denali, Aconcagua in South America. I frankly think it's a little bit of a circus. It's a commercial circus, and 10,000 people climbing Kilimanjaro every year. If they do, I do think there should be a qualifying. I think it's the same thing as you want to go in the New York Marathon, if you want to go to the Hawaiian Ironman. You know, these big races, so many people want to do it now. You know, you've got to have a qualifying, and the qualifying is pretty steep. You know, you can't just turn up. So I think if so many people want to climb Everest and big mountains because of this striving, in many, not in all cases, but this striving to have that Instagram picture, yes, we need a qualifying. If they make it Nepali peaks, the Nepalese peaks, I think that'll expand the number of mountains in Nepal, and I think it'll be a great idea.
Do you have any other suggestions for solving this Everest fever that we've been talking about?
Well, they're looking at putting the price up. I mean, that will always filter, because what's happened on Everest the last few years is the Sherpas have really taken control of their own destiny, which is good in many ways. It's not Western guides getting all the money and, you know, charging high prices. So the prices have come down. Unfortunately, with that, some of the standards have come down as well. And that's why cuts have been taken, safety cuts being taken. So I think, you know, putting the price up will, you know, okay, some people might say, well, makes it then a sport for the rich, true, but it will make it something that you really need to be determined about. And I always ask myself, people ask me, you know, people come to me all the time, I want to climb Everest, how do I go about it? And before I go into that technical, I say, well, let me ask you a question. Why exactly do you want to climb Everest? You know, what are you trying to achieve here? And they say, well, climb Everest, whatever. And then I say, for the sake of what? And really then, for the sake of what, strip it down, really get that clear goal. And that'll sort of take out the wannabes, the publicity seekers, the Instagrams, look at me's and things from the real serious climbers to a degree.
So in a sense, just further education, further discussion before one just decides this is what he or she wants to do, actually make sure the interested understand what the dangers are and what it all entails and the price and the fact that it is deadly.
Yeah, it's deadly. Safety-wise, it's become safer over the years. As I said, one or two climbers in 100 summits is a manageable risk. Most climbers would think it is. When you come to K2 in a minute, I'll tell you a different statistic. But I would say anyone hoping to strike it famous, recognition, respect, and 500,000 Instagram followers just by climbing Everest, forget it. It's all been done now. All the firsts have been done. And you now have to do something absolutely phenomenal to get that respect and recognition and so-called fame. And I'm speaking particularly about Alex Honnold, free solo, El Capitan in Yosemite. And the guy is an integral guy. He's a phenomenal climber. Free climbing that big wall without ropes, that's the sort of, boundaries that people are having to do to get that recognition, if recognition is your objective, of course. That's another big question.
Now, Adrian Hayes, I want to switch to your new book, One Man's Climb, A Journey of Trauma, Tragedy, and Triumph on K2. It chronicles your summit of K2 in 2014, following the loss of two climbing partners on the mountain the year before. So why'd you go back in 2014?
Yeah, well, I should explain K2 for those listening. I mean, K2, the second highest mountain in the world, located on the Pakistan-Chinese border, 1,000 miles further north than Everest, which is on the Nepal-Tibet border. It's a gargantuan challenge. It's way steeper. It's a technical rock climb. It's a technical ice climb, avalanche dangers, rockfall dangers, deep snow, isolated, remote. So it's an altogether different challenge. Everest has been climbed by about 7,500 people now, whereas K2 is little over 400. So it's chalk and cheese. And the stats for every four historically get to the top of K2, one has died trying. So it's a 25% summit to death ratio as opposed to Everest, which is about 1-2%. So massive challenge. Why do you want to go back? Well, again, I mean, I'm honest enough to admit that I did this for what I've always done, these big goals throughout my whole life since I was 16. It's for this internal significance, this striving for achievement, personal goals, escape, getting away from it all, personal challenge, all these things. But, when you get your mindset to these goals, going back after we were taken, foreshortened on the first year, it just became a blink of mindset, just something that I just had to go back and do.
Pardon my assumption here, but I am assuming your 2014 climb was extremely emotional, and knowing the danger of the mountain as you just described, did you try to control those emotions while you were climbing in 2014, and if so, how?
I think with these mountains and the hindsight of 2013, and there was a spur, because sometimes it takes something to happen to really push us to actually go for a goal. It was a trauma in my personal life, which, we can succumb to the dark stuff, we can go into depression, or we can sort of bury our head into a massive goal, a massive physical goal or business goal, whatever it is. But I think the hindsight of 2013, I still allowed that personal trauma to perhaps take my eye off the ball once or twice. And in hindsight, it's a great thing. Maybe it was the right thing, to come down in the end. 2014, there was no choice. It literally was blinkers on, absolute mindset. You cannot do these massive, massive goals with any distractions back home of any sort. Because if you take your eye off the ball, even for 1 second, it could be the danger between a rock hitting your head or missing an avalanche and everything like this. You've got to have this blinkered mindset. It's not so much selfish as self-preservation. It's just the only way to attempt such a dangerous and formidable feat as K2 is.
This is not your first book chronicling your extensive adventure experiences. Knowing that a journey might later be something that you put down on the page, do you approach a climb or a hike or an adventure differently because of that?
No, well, the first book I wrote was a trek through the Arabian Desert, and that was a 44-day trek mainly a cultural thing. We had a film documentary with us. So that was a clear objective of that. It wasn't about fastest and hardest and boldest and quickest, all that thing. It was a cultural thing about the Bedouin of Arabia. The K2 story, I mean, the book, I didn't intend to write a book about it at all. I was asked to write it 2 years after I summited by the daughter of the US-born climber who sadly died on the first year, Marty Smith, his daughter Sequoia, asked me to write a book, and that's what I did. But I found it very hard to write a book on the journey alone. It was only when I started to expand it into other areas, and basically, you know, lessons from my work as a coach, as a sociologist, as a campaigner, and really looking at the world below, views from the top, lessons on risk and reward and everything. And I put all that stuff in, and as well as the personal story. And so we've ended up with a book that's as much a book on human development, society and the world we live in, as it is the story of climbing a mountain. That's why it should appeal to men and women of all ages and persuasions, not just mountain lovers.
So, Adrian, what is your next goal, your next adventure?
Well, top secret, Jim. I'll have to kill you if I tell you. Well, the personal story took on an uncanny twist, and my daughter, which I'm giving the game away here now, but daughter lives with me, and she's my absolute priority right now for the last 2 years and probably for another year or so. But I will go back to Himalayas. I mean, I'm an all-rounder. I'm not coming on, you know, your show or promoting this book pretending to be the world's greatest alpinist or even North America's or Britain's. You know, I polar work, desert, jungles, everything. I've done a lot. And adventuring is only part of my work. So I've got other things going on. But I'll go back to the Himalayas because I know it well. I was a Gurkha officer for 8 years in the Gurkhas. I speak Nepali. I know the country like the back of my hand. So there is a real joy going back there and really getting away from it all and really getting the lessons from it as opposed to, you know, trying to get the first uphill, the hardest, the longest, the boldest. So I will go back. We'll see if it's next year or shortly after.
Adrian Hayes is the author of One Man's Climb, A Journey of Trauma, Tragedy, and Triumph on K2. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks very much, mate. All our best.